I'm Mark Steiner, and I want to welcome you all to the 11th Annual Annapolis Summit here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA-FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're doing this Annapolis Summit in this 11th year. It's here with our partners, the Daily Record, who have printed some incredible publications around this. We've been able to start this year with articles on the Daily Record on the major issues that we've also put on our radio program. It's been great to work in concert with this team at the Daily Record. Our sponsors are the Stevenson University, our primary sponsor, Anderson and Cleaver, the Maryland State Education Association, the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Our production partner is VPC, and of course our media partner is our home station, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And our first hour here, we're going to be talking to Governor Martin O'Malley, who's making his way here to the event. He's dropping off his son to school first. Who can argue with that? But let me begin. We usually begin our program every day with this day in history. So let's begin that, as we usually do with this day in history. On this day in history, in 1746, Bonnie Prince Charlie occupied Stirling in the Second Jacobite Rising of 1746. This was the day in 1790 that George Washington delivered the first State of the Union Address in New York City. Now, this is the day in 1811. There was a man named Charles Delon. Charles Delon was a slave in Haiti who was brought to Louisiana after the revolution in Haiti. Many people fled to Louisiana. Many people who were of mixed race fled to Louisiana and brought their slaves, as did white people. And he was brought to Louisiana. He led one of the first great slave rebellions in the United States of America on the German coast. It was called the 1811 German Coast Uprising. He gathered 200 slaves from plantations across that led a fight for their freedom. The white planters formed militias. All the slaves were killed. He was tortured to death at the end when he was captured. But his name among slave and slave owners remained alive for 200 years as a man who stood up and fought for his freedom. This was a day just a few years later, 1815, that the Battle of New Orleans took place with Andrew Jackson leading the American forces to victory over the British. And this is the day, 1835, the only time that the U.S. national debt was at zero. 1835. And this is the day in 1867 that legislation giving suffrage to African Americans in the District of Columbia was passed over Andrew Johnson's veto in 1867. This was the day in 1877 that Crazy Horse and his warriors fought their last great battle against the United States Cavalry at Wolf Mountain in what's now Montana. And this was the day in 1912 that the African National Congress was founded in South Africa. And this is the day in 1920, the Great Steel Strike of 1919 ended, but it became a complete failure for the Amalgamation Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers Laborers Union. It was crushed on this day in 1920. This was the day that 1964, that Lyndon B. Johnson declared his war on poverty in the United States. And on Monday, the Mark Steiner Show will do an hour dedicated to that anniversary of the war on poverty and see where we are after all these years. This was the day in 1973, the Watergate scandal erupted. The trial of seven men accused of breaking into the Watergate, Democratic Party headquarters, was on this day in 1973. This is the day that Ellie T. Grosso in 1975 became the first woman governor in the United States, as other than succeeding a husband, elected on her own right. And this is the day in 1989 that the oldest integration lawsuit in the United States was settled with the St. Helena Parish Schools that became officially integrated in 1989. The suit was brought by John Hall and the NAACP in 1952. The last one settled, 1989. It takes a long time for change to happen. This is the day in 2002 that President George W. Bush signed into law No Child Left Behind. So we'll deal with its descendant today when the governor and the president and the speaker arrive. This is a day in 2010 in 2011, the attempted assassination of Gabrielle Giffords took place at Casa Adobes, Arizona, at the Safeway grocery store that killed Jared Lee Loeffner, for which Jared Lee Loeffner was arrested. Six people were killed, 13 wounded, including the Giffords. And that was on this day. And she was a remarkable human being, as we all saw her fight for recovery, stand up to go back to Congress, and finally leave. This goes through some birthdays. On this day in 1926, Soupy Sales, who remembers Soupy Sales, was born in 1926, died in 2009. This is a day that Charles Osgood was born in 1933, one of our great journalists. Aha. This is the day in 1935, Elvis Presley was born. That sounds such a long time ago, 1935. And he was born on this day, and of course that's huge for many people to think about the crossover, the songs he took out of the black community and then made a success out of them, and it took that. And that's always been a controversy over who controls whose music. This is the day in 1836 that Fannie M. Jackson was born. Her last name became Coppin, Fannie M. Jackson Coppin. She was the first black woman to graduate college in the United States of America. She was born this day in 1836. She graduated from Oberlin University in 1865 and became an educator and a leader. Coppin State University was named after her. She helped found that institution. Her descendants helped found that institution. That institution is named after her. This is the day in 1942 that Stephen Hawking was born. Hawking was born, the great English physicist and author. And my dear friend, Kojo Nandi, from WAMU in Washington, D.C., was born on this day in 1945. This is the day that David Bowie was born in 1947. One of our favorites today was born in 1983, Kim Jong-un, the third supreme leader of North Korea. And this was also the day in 1922 that Charles Young passed away. Charles Young was the third African-American to ever graduate West Point, but he became the first colonel, the first black superintendent of a national park, and one of our great American heroes died on this day. And that is this day in history, and this is our time to start. Governor Martin O'Malley is walking in the door. Good to have you here. Thank you.
Good to be here. This is our last one of these.
This is our last one of these.
Everybody say, aw. It's our last one.
And what do you think about that?
Time flies.
It does. And I was thinking about the 8 years ago when we started this together. I'm glad you started there. Let me start this way. Assuming, let's say, you get the minimum wage passed this year and get this done in the state of Maryland, we'll talk about it in a minute. A lot has gone on in the almost 8 years now you've been governor of the state of Maryland. This is your last year. What are the things that you can reflect on that you didn't get that you'd want to get?
And this is where you're going to start?
I think we'd start, or you think we still have places to go. Do you know what I mean?
Well, of course we have places to go. I mean, we're a free people. This is a great state, and this is a republic that still has 200 years of creative service in front of her. So our journey's not over. Our best days are still ahead of us. And what I see happening in our state is Maryland leadership in the face of the sort of economic doubt, the economic adversity that we've faced over these last few years. Rather than simply wishing that the economy would get better, we took actions. Even as other states were jettisoning their investments in public education, we did more rather than less. We did more rather than less on innovation. We did more rather than less to rebuild a modern infrastructure, not only in terms of new schools and new classrooms, but also new water, wastewater infrastructure, and more recently, new transportation infrastructure. All of these things propelled our state out of this recession in advance of others. Our unemployment rate has been driven down to 6.4% now. Last year, we had the best rate of new job creation of any state in our region, and it was a rate of new job creation that was 88% faster than our good neighbors in the Commonwealth of Virginia. But we still have work to do, because there has been, because of the poor decisions of our shared history as a country over these last 30 years, our economy was pretty well wrecked. And that notion, that reality, rather, of the American dream, where if you work harder, you can get ahead, you can do better by and for your family, That's been kind of battered and torn. And so that's why this session we will be pushing for an increase in the minimum wage. Had the minimum wage merely kept pace with inflation since 1968, it would already be $10.75. So there's a lot of work that we still have to do. And we do it the way our parents and grandparents did. We do it by making the modern investments that a modern economy requires in order to give our children a future with more opportunity rather than less. And that work goes on. And we're better situated to do it than most other states. We've been, to quote Pete Rawlings, we have been socially responsible, and we've also been fiscally prudent, or is it fiscally prudent and socially responsible? In any event,
whichever one you want to put first.
We have applied a more balanced approach, and that that is true also in terms of our getting our fiscal house in order, retiring, for the most part, the $1.7 billion deficit that we inherited as an administration, maintaining a AAA bond rating. We're one of only seven states, I think, in the depths of the recession that still hung on to that. And so those things put us on good footing. The size of our state government, the executive branch is smaller now on a per capita basis than it's been at any time since 1973. And most exciting and hardest to talk about, really, or get any interest in a broader sense, are the common platforms for collaboration that have been built over these last few years. I'm talking about BayStat. I'm talking about the public safety platforms. Health IT platforms, not to be confused with the health shopping website, healthcare shopping website, but health IT platforms for population health management. And you see the results, most importantly, when it comes to saving young lives. I mean, we've cut juvenile homicides in half as a people over these last 7 years. And it wasn't some magic, easy button solution. It was a whole continuum of care, including reducing foster care placements, out-of-home placements by 42%, healing the family with Family First. All of these things made a difference, and we need to continue to make a difference because we still bury too many young people in our state from violent crime.
So, Governor, one of the things we're going to do, we have people lined up there, you see, to ask questions, and we're going to get to the audience. I'll ask a question. We'll come to the audience. I think the first question out there. And the second question will go to young people from the Baltimore Urban Debate League who have arrived to take part in today's events as well. But let me ask, one of the things that's clearly at the top of the news today is the health care exchange rollout. And you've seen that Congressman Delaney and Delegate Heather Mazier, have questioned whether or not we should just move into the federal site and let our site drop because we've had so much difficulty. A, what's your thought about that? And B, why do you think, since we were one of the first ones to start and $150 million spent, we're having such difficulties getting this site rolling? What's the root of it?
Let me answer the first part first. It is not a bad question. It's a question that we have all been asking ourselves ever since the first days of the launch, which did not meet our expectations or our plans. It's a good question. It's a question we still continue to ask ourselves every day, even as we have greatly improved the functionality of the site. Our goal, albeit a very ambitious goal, some would say perhaps set too high, but our goal was to ensure 260,000 people by the end of open enrollment. These are people that do not yet have insurance. 260,000 people by the end of March. As we speak today, a little over the halfway mark in that six-month enrollment from October 1st now to the end of March, we are at approximately 170,000 people that have been enrolled, 90,000 of them, 91,000, because of the pre-enrollment and primary adult care, which was something we did in Maryland with the Lieutenant Governor's leadership in anticipation of the Affordable Care. We expanded it. We aggressively marketed it early before the website went up. In terms of the website itself, that's about 70,000 people that have come through that portal, through the website itself. Many things have been fixed, and in fact, our portal is actually superior right now in functionality compared to the federal government when it comes to those that are covered by Medicaid, and that has been the majority of those that so far have signed up for additional coverage because of how miserly we were and how restrictive we used to be as a state when it came to Medicaid eligibility. If there were a better platform, whether it was a federal platform, whether it was a California platform or a Canadian platform, whatever the platform was, if there were a better one immediately available that were more functional than ours, and we could go to it without impacting our enrollment goals, we certainly would. But answering that question is a little more in-depth than just wishing that the grass were greener on the other side. Did that answer your question? You want?
I guess. I mean, are you saying that we're not going to do that? We're not going to move our...
Oh, we still may, or we may go to parts of it.
I mean, are there things in places like California and other states whose sites seem to be working really well did that we didn't do that we can learn from what they did?
Yeah, there appears to be some advantage to the economies of scale on these IT projects. Set aside, though, you want to say, well, why didn't the federal government work as well as California and New York? There seems to be some advantage in terms of economies of scale and in the functionality of these sites. There's also a great variance in terms of the press knowledge from state to state with regard to the functionality of these sites. I mean, to state it kindly, in some places the full functionality is not as well known as it is in some in other places. And so I don't want to go too far in the weeds, Mark, but yeah. I'm glad to, because I get twice daily updates on this and have spent more time on this sort of state emergency management operation over these last few months. The bottom line, though, is if you were to look at a thermometer, we've all been looking at thermometers these last 2 days, let's be honest. If you were to look at a thermometer, we are at 170,000 enrollees on our way to 260,000 by the end of March. And the site has now been made functional for most people. Are there still problems? Sure. Do some applications still get stuck? Sure. Some do. But I can tell you this. There's not a single person that's been denied coverage because of a prior existing condition. There's not a single woman who's been charged more for health insurance coverage because she is a woman. And those are big strides that we've made. And even before the Affordable Care Act, we had enrolled approximately 400,000 people as a state. So right now, in the enrollment process, we want to get to 260. Prior to this, we had enrolled 400,000 as a people because of the dollar tax on tobacco.
Let me move to the audience. First question out. Introduce yourself and ask your question. Remember, keep it pithy if you can.
And humorous.
A lot of people. And humorous. Yes.
Here we go. Don Rush from radio station WSCL. I had a question about the phosphorus regulations for the farmers. There's been some suggestion that there should be some kind of economic impact of these kinds of regulations. Certainly farmers have pushed back. Some have suggested that these regulations may very well be dead, the new ones, because they were withdrawn. Where are you on that? Would you favor some kind of economic impact study before such regulations go into effect?
Yeah, to the listeners, I encourage you to go on to the state government website. Click on BayStat learn more about the various causes that degrade the health of our waters, our streams, our creeks, our rivers, and therefore our bay. The four main drivers are nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment. They come from four primary sources: farm runoff, sewage, stormwater, suburban and urban stormwater runoff, and then fourth, septic leach. So, on this question, we have known for some time, and the scientists all tell us, that there are some farms, some soils in our state that are so heavily saturated with phosphorus that it will be years and years before the health of those soils is restored by the runoff of that phosphorus into the watershed in which that farm finds itself. Now, in some places of our state, where the practice of spreading poultry manure has been more prevalent than others, that's where you have the highest index, in other words, the greatest level of saturation. So we have been advancing a new standard to measure when that soil is is saturated. And then for farmers, that leads to the practical implication of, okay, now what do I do with all this chicken manure? And this is something that we have been not only planning around, something we've been debating. We've had more public hearings on this than most zoning issues in Baltimore City, and that's saying something. We are phasing in that new phosphorus measure, and the state is working with farmers and being helpful to farmers in establishing some infrastructure so that we can contain properly poultry manure and divert it to other places where it can be used in ways that are not as harmful to the waterways as it is when it's spread in totally saturated soils that have a high P index. So that's the long answer to the short question. We're phasing in those regs. And you want to follow up?
Yeah, just
sure.
But so, very quick, because we have a lot of folks, okay?
So would you favor some kind of either legislation or rule for deciding or gauging the economic impact of these regulations?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, not only on terms of regulations, but also in laws and in the investments we make as a people. There is no decision or choice that we make that does not have, especially in these 90 days, that doesn't involve some sort of short-term and long-term balance, that doesn't involve some cost and benefit analysis. And certainly regulations that protect the waterways and our environment are one of those. We've had a much easier time quantifying some things that have immediate dollar values than we do things that in the past we never had to attach a value to, like clean air, clean water, and the like. So we can certainly look at all of those things. We have reduced pages and pages of regulation as a state. Our overarching umbrella for this is called Maryland Made Easy, and also the business portal that we have put in place. But I ask you, what is the cost to the children of the farmers in those heavily saturated soils, the children of the watermen, and the children of the other people of any profession in that area if their river dies? What is the value of the Wicomico River? And how do you measure that against the inconvenience of finding another place to store chicken for a few months in the winter?
So let me just be able to, the young people from Boodle will get your question right after the break, because we have like 4 minutes, but we have to go to a quick break and come right back to continue with Governor Martin O'Malley. And there's some questions I want to get out here, too, about some things that have to get on the table. And when we come back, what I'd like, though, to follow up with what he was asking just about this one particular thing, is it seems like every legislation that we have that has to do with restoring the health of the bay gets put off or doesn't function.
That's not true.
Well, let me explain what I mean. See, you can.
In fact, you have seen the greatest strides over these last 4 years, Mark, in terms of the cleanup of the bay that we've seen, I would argue, in some 30 years. I mean, certainly if you measure it from the beginning of the flush tax forward, that's simply not true.
We're going to take a break. I'll come back and ask that question, just push a little bit,
okay.
And we'll go to the kids from Boodle, and people from Boodle. We'll hit all the other major subjects here that have to be raised very quickly in the next half hour that we have. You're here at the Annapolis Summit on the Mark Steiner Show, at Annapolis Summit with the Daily Record. And we're going to take a brief break here at WEAA and come right back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm Mark Steiner, and we're here at the 11th Annual Annapolis Summit with our partner, the Daily Record. And we've done for 11 years now. Governor Martin O'Malley has been generous every year to be with us. He's here on the stage with us now at the Calvert House in Annapolis, where we're broadcasting from. Before we turn to the audience and our young people from Boodle, just a quick follow-up. I mean, what I mean by that, what I meant earlier before we went to break, Governor, is that the what people call the rain tax the doesn't seem to be working in the state. Every locality had its own way of doing it. Some localities did not implement it at all or implemented one-penny taxes that have done nothing to address the issue, which could put federal money coming to us in jeopardy. And B, the phosphorus management tool that was created was fairly strongly scientifically based, I mean, about how it was going to work to help farmers and the rest of us know where these pollutants were coming from the farm to the rivers. And again, it's been pushed off. So that's what I mean when I say it seems always to be pushed down the road rather than getting it done.
I don't I don't see these things as things that are being pushed off so much as I see them as things that are being pushed forward. I mean, 4 years ago, if you had asked most people around this circle whether they thought there would ever be a regimen put in place that would allow us to control suburban stormwater runoff, they would say, certainly not over the foreseeable horizon. And yet, as a people, we came together and we did that. Yes, the counties asked for great flexibility. Yes, some have done a better job than others. Yes. And there are differences from one county to the other. But this covers the stormwater remediation and the dollars that allow that to happen. Those regimens were required in, I think, only 10 of the 24 counties. And some of those that are the biggest voices decrying the so-called rain tax or actually represent counties where there is none. And in some counties, some of the larger ones, like Montgomery and Prince George's, it's actually been implemented pretty well. Anne Arundel, which is so porous and has so many, you know, rivers and streams, even Anne Arundel has made progress on theirs. There's some differences when it comes to treating nonprofits and Baltimore City, I know, is treating nonprofits differently than in some other jurisdictions. So, and some jurisdictions are thumbing their nose at it, and they'll work their way through that as they look at the other trade-offs and the consequences down the road. But this is important movement. Let me give you the other one: the septics and the bill that was passed that will curb and prevent the proliferation of McMansion developments on septic systems. There's not many states, if any other states, that have been able to do what we have done these last 4 years when it comes to the health of our waters. And this, what we are doing, the way we are doing it with openness and transparency, also involves a higher degree of public discussion and public discourse. What you identify as being pushed off, mm-hmm. I see as public engagement, dialogue, collaboration, discourse. There were many that said, don't even bother with the phosphorus regs. It'll never happen. Don't push it forward. And now it's moving forward. It's moving forward in a phased way. And some other things that don't make as much news, we've also done for the first time. I mean, look at the amount of acreage farmers now put into cover crops in the winter to suck up that nitrogen and that phosphorus. We've gone from doing about 150,000 acres a year now to doing over 400,000 acres a year.
So let me, in all fairness to our people here, go to the audience.
We should do a full show on the Bay. Can we do that sometime?
You want to come on and just do a whole show on the Bay?
I'd love to do a whole show on the Bay. I'd love to do a whole show on education.
I would welcome that. We could do one at Morgan State University, we could do another one at Salisbury University, and we can just roll it out. I'd love to do that.
Yeah, something a little. Yeah,
we'll work with Nina Smith to get that done.
Yeah, because there's a new way that we are governing ourselves as a people, and I'm not entirely sure I've done a very good job of communicating that to the people I love and serve.
Baltimore Urban Debate League, go ahead. Your question.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, my name's Ronald.
Hello, Ronald.
And I would like to ask, how can the General Assembly better structure the Open Meetings Act to allow for more meaningful enforcement, particularly in Baltimore?
Wow. Ronald, have you been studying the Open Meetings Act?
These kids are amazing. They're amazing.
That's very cool. What grade are you in, Ronald?
I'm in six.
In sixth grade. Cool. My son's in fifth grade. And then my older son is 16. He does debate stuff, too. So, Ronald, I'm not sure I know that when I was mayor of Baltimore that, I mean, we had open meetings not only on the city council and at the Board of Estimates, but also the pre-meeting to the Board of Estimates was opened up. And what is the problem that you've identified where you think that there's not enough sunshine and not enough openness in the workings of Baltimore City?
Recently, I have found out that at some points of time that the government has been allowing the public to join in some of the meetings and not giving them a reason, even when they're spending their tax money or is something that involves the community.
Huh. Do you see this? I think one area where we need some more public engagement and openness, visibility, transparency has to do in the management of our school systems and the meetings and workings of our school boards. It is a huge, huge cost center, and many of them are operated with a great deal of autonomy, especially when compared to the other departments of the city of Baltimore or any county. I mean, the school boards become almost their own entity unto themselves, and given the importance there, I would think that maybe that might be a place where we need some clearer direction on openness and transparency. So I'll be looking for that, Bill. I haven't focused on that one. I'm glad you are.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ronald.
Thank you.
Before we get to our next, thank you so much, Ryan, our next audience member. On September 25th, our highest court guaranteed the constitutional right for a lawyer at bail. I know negotiations have been going on fast and furious in Annapolis even before the session started around this. I wonder what your plans are, what you plan to announce about how that is going to be implemented and when it will be implemented now that it's a constitutional guarantee.
Yeah. It's funny. This case has twice gone to the Court of Appeals. The first time they did not find a constitutional guarantee, and miraculously they found one the second time it was up there. The first time they said the legislature needed to be clearer about the statute, so the legislature was clearer about the statute, passed a new law, and then the Court of Appeals somehow found this constitutional guarantee that we had never discovered there in the past, over however long we've had a constitution. So I think that the judicial review and the judicial process has not fully run its course in this matter. And so I think the Court of Appeals will probably be looking at this matter once again. And I look forward to hearing their opinion with a fresh look at this issue.
Does that mean that you're not going to kind of commit to enacting what they say is a constitutional right, lawyer bail now, and making sure that everybody has one in the state? I mean, what is going to be the next step?
Well, the state has rights, too, and those rights apply to the judicial process and the appeals process, and so we will be following that process and going through that process, and at its conclusion, since the Court of Appeals has had some, has ruled a couple of different ways on this, once they make a final determination, the legislature is one branch of government, the executive another, and the judiciary a third. So we look forward to their review of this matter and the exhaustion of the appellate process. And we'll work collaboratively with all branches in order to come up with the right path forward.
So given that most people who are in jail come out of poverty and can't afford lawyers, are you saying you don't think they should have the right to a lawyer at their first bail hearing?
Yeah, I'm saying that in Baltimore City, we made some changes a number of years ago that you may recall, Mark, to make sure that poor people didn't sit and languish in Baltimore City jail for 60 days waiting for their first district court appearance. It wasn't easy to make those changes, but we put in place the early disposition court. And instead of people waiting for 2 months to get a stet for a disorderly charge or a minor theft charge, they actually are seen by a judge within 24 hours and are out of the system, and they have lawyers there present. What we're talking about is the court commissioner hearing. So what we're talking about is the court commissioners, and there are hundreds and hundreds of them that set the bail on an immediate basis with pretrial. So there are very few states that go through the sort of laborious two-step process that we do. There are some that are urging, and I think there's a lot of merit to this, urging us to abandon the court commissioner system as we've been doing it and do away with that step in the process and instead accelerate that first appearance that can
right.
be done in a court. I think that there may be some merit in going in that direction, but I think the Court of Appeals appellate process still has to run its course.
Let's go back to the audience, and then we go ahead.
Thank you, Mark. Governor, my name is Doug Colbert. I'm a law professor at Maryland Law School, and I just wanted to.
This has been your life's cause, Doug.
Well, thank you, Governor, and I'm hoping that with your assistance you can allow me to move on to other causes. But what we're looking at, and this is a very important decision that the Court of Appeals rendered in late September, they did declare that poor people have a constitutional right to a lawyer at their first appearance when liberty is at stake. And I know that change is always difficult for people to accept, even when there are recognized benefits to the change. So my question is, I'm hoping that you can, as a lawyer, as somebody who's very familiar with our justice system, if you could share with us what's the upside to guaranteeing that poor people have legal representation when their liberty is at stake, and what problems, if any, do you anticipate in implementing the Court of Appeals ruling?
I think that some of the changes that we made in Baltimore City many years ago with the early disposition court were very needed, very important, and I think were long overdue. I mean, I was a district court prosecutor in Baltimore City for a couple of years, a little shy of a couple of years, and I used to see the cases coming out of the holding area, and people coming in and in handcuffs that had been languishing in Baltimore City Jail for 60 days because nobody loved them enough to post bail, because they had a history of not showing up for court, and all those other different indicia. So I think they're better diagnostics and better tools than we've ever had for examining whether or not a person is a risk of flight or a danger to the public. We've used these tools to great effect in parole and probation. We've used these tools to great effect in better diagnosing those juvenile cases where the children are most vulnerable or most a threat to, or a greatest threat to others. And I think that these sorts of reforms can and should be brought forward when it comes to the way that Maryland sets bails at that first court commissioner hearing, right after a person is arrested by a police officer. So I think there are some things we can do there, and perhaps it's time to eliminate the court commissioner process altogether. And once the Court of Appeals makes its final ruling, we can have those conversations and look at the trade-offs there. But to divert, so that's kind of where I stand on that. I know from some perspectives it appears easy to simply ask the public defender to go find another $60 or $70 million and make this a lawyer's full employment act and put lawyers in each of those tiny little cubicles with every court commissioner on the thousands of cases where people are arrested. There are others that would look at that and say that there's a better way to accomplish the due process and the respect of individual freedoms and rights. Thank you, and for your passion as well. Tell Matt I said hi.
Back to the audience.
Hi, my name is Gail Rand. I'm an Annapolis resident. I'm also a mother of three kids, and my youngest son, Logan, has epilepsy. And I wanted to talk to you about opportunities for medical cannabis in the state of Maryland. I'm very familiar with House Bill 1101, but due to the limitations of the medical academic centers that have not signed up at all, I'm concerned about him being able to get access. I know that there was a Goucher poll that showed that 90% of Marylanders approve of medical cannabis use, and I'm not sure there's a more nonpartisan issue out there. I know that you expressed that your goal is to have more opportunities than less for children. I think for my son and many children out there, there's no more opportunity that they could have than have the medicine that they need to be fruitful and successful. So my question is, I'd like to know what you and the state are doing to actually truly allow medical cannabis access for kids like my son.
Right. Thank you. This issue will no doubt be discussed once again in this General Assembly session. I think it was it 2 years ago that the medical marijuana bill was signed? Three?
Last year.
Just last year.
Last year.
Wow. These are like... It's a vortex I'm in for one more year that distorts time. So we signed that bill last year. I spoke to one of the members of the commission. I know they'll be coming out with more recommendations. So we're going to have this conversation. I am not Well, let me say it in a positive way. I think all of us have heard enough, I mean, have heard many stories, like the story you kindly shared with us about your son and his epilepsy. There's a mix of science as to how proven this particular drug is, but certainly anecdotally, we all know people who have been suffering from, whether it's pancreatic cancer or any sort of cancer, and the treatments from that and the nausea that it creates, who claim to have had their suffering alleviated, their symptoms alleviated. And so our hope is, if there's something that's made this too cumbersome to move it forward in the context of medical marijuana, that we can fix that this legislative session. And so that's where I am on it, and I look forward to working with you and the General Assembly on this issue, because I do think that the bill that was passed represented a consensus that we needed to find a way to move forward on medical marijuana in a responsible way that doesn't promote recreational use and, you know, the gateway.
So, to it, do you, what's your stand on the decriminalization and or legalization of marijuana, which will be debated in the House and Senate this year?
Yeah, I'm not much in favor of it.
Why?
Because I've seen what drug addiction has done to the people of our state and the people of our city. And I also know that that this drug and its use and its abuse can be a gateway to even more harmful behavior. And I know that there are those who say, yes, you can say the same about alcohol, and yes, that's true. But I don't think that the answer is to promote greater access and greater recreational abuse of drugs, whether it's this particular drug or any other drug.
So you disagree with what happened in Washington and Colorado? You'd be opposed to that?
Yeah, I'm not much in favor of that.
In Colorado, there's been some research that 85% of the children with epilepsy that have gotten access to medical cannabis have reduced their seizures by 60 to 100%. So there's only 15% of the children out there that are not being helped by this medicine, and there's been no increase in crime or any issues with the medical legalization.
And what's the format? What's the form in which they take it?
It's an oil. It's an oil tincture. So there's a specific organization out in Colorado that manages the growing. It's very regulated, and they extract the oil and they administer it through either directly through an oil or with honey into the mouth. Right. And it's administered by like a medicine with neurological and doctor's approvals recommendations for this medicine.
And that's why I signed the medical marijuana bill. And if we need to fix it, if there's something broken or something that makes it too cumbersome, we can take advantage of these next 90 days and do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, well, I do have a follow-up with that, but let me ask another question before we get to the next person in line. That in 2002, when we passed Thornton, there was supposed to be this commission to look at the adequacy of education that was pushed off in 2012 and pushed down the road. It didn't happen. It was supposed to happen in 2012. It didn't happen. So we have a new governor coming in, probably 50 new legislators coming in next January, maybe more. We don't know. A brand new day on lots of levels. So do you support kind of impaneling this Thornton II commission this year? It's been pushed off and off, so that the next body of legislators can actually wrestle with money, wrestle with whether it's worked, wrestle with the growth in Title I kids, wrestle with the growth in kids with English proficiency, all the other issues that face our schools. I mean, are you going to impanel that?
Yeah, I wasn't cognizant of the fact that I unimpaneled it.
Well, I don't know if you unimpaneled, but I know that it was kind of pushed off. It was supposed to be done by June 30th of 2012, but didn't happen.
Be glad to follow up with you after, Mark. I'm not aware. I know that there was a consultant's report in Dr. Grasmick's last year that was released with a lot of public input and a lot of hearings. And this one escapes me. I'm not aware of this one. But I would encourage everyone to look at the history of education funding in Maryland, because you will see It's one of the very few areas of your state government that has been pretty substantially increased over these last few difficult years. I mean, we have, and we've all been paying for that. We paid for it with the additional penny on the sales tax, moved us from the 42nd lowest sales tax in the country to the 31st lowest sales tax in the country. But those dollars all went into that increase in education funding that have allowed us to achieve for the first time ever and ever before the distinction of being named the number one public schools in America for 5 years in a row. And we have made some tremendous strides in closing the achievement gap between kids from families of lower incomes and all their other peers.
So most of the Democratic candidates now for governor are talking about pre-K, universal pre-K. Are you about to announce something in your State of Union address?
Yes, we'll have the Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown is passionate about this issue of pre-K. I am also passionate, as I've saw firsthand in Baltimore City. Once we had that first cohort of kids, Mark, that had the benefit of full-day kindergarten, we saw them score above the national average in reading and math. That had never happened before. And people said, they'll lose their gains after once they're in second and third grade. But they did not. I mean, once kids come to school more ready to learn, and we've had some great programs so that kids enter even the pre-K aspect of their development in a better prepared to learn. So I think what you will see from the O'Malley Brown administration is the first steps on this road of expanding to universal pre-K, and it'll be a positive development and one that we can do, I believe, in a fiscally prudent way and a substantial way this year.
Let's go back to the audience, and I will just say that it wasn't you who put it off. I didn't want that impression to be left out there. When it came to the Fortin Plan, it was the General Assembly that put it off in 2012.
And at this stage, sometimes they don't even ask me. Yeah.
Good morning, Governor. My name is Chris Floor. I'm a criminal defense attorney and former director of the legal director of the Lawyers at Bail Project. Your task force that was convened on the issue of bail had come out with a recommendation that there was going to be an elimination of money bail, bringing us in line with states like Kentucky and Colorado. Chief Judge Clyburn just spoke about that yesterday, or was quoted about that yesterday. I just wondered what you thought about the task force recommendation about eliminating money bail.
Well, I'm open to approaches that work best. That's what I'm for, that protect people's constitutional rights and that work best for the administration of justice and due process, fairness, and everything that goes with those broad terms. So I'm for whatever works. I'm for what works and what works best.
Thanks for the opportunity, Governor. Thanks for your service to us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next person.
Good morning, Governor O'Malley. Betty Weller, President, Maryland State Education Association. I first want to thank you very much because during your first two terms as governor, you were a true leader in advocating for and delivering the investment that our schools and our students needed to be successful. Your work and your advocacy during even these tough times during a recession has allowed us to demonstrate that success.
Thank you, Betty.
You're quite welcome. I would like to know what your vision is of how we can successfully support and fund our schools and make sure that we continue to move forward as we have during your time in office, and what your position is on a Thornton II commission.
Yep. The most important imperative that we all have as a people is to get our economy to grow and to expand economic opportunity for greater earning to more people, which is why we've made these investments in better and higher levels of learning. The more a person learns, the more a person earns. And so the most important thing that we can do in our journey is to accelerate the innovation curve, accelerate the levels of achievement so that we can create more jobs in this knowledge-based and information-based economy. And that will allow us to sustain these investments we've made in public education. As far as Thornton II and looking down the road, I think we always benefit from looking further down the road, provided we set up more immediate benchmarks for taking action. And I smile because I think of the Chesapeake Bay, where in the past we set 40-year goals, and none of the gray suits that set them were around to be accountable for any of the actions that we took in between. So I think we benefit from looking longer term. I'm for that. I think the next The next big stride we need to make is on that pre-K and figuring out how to get there. It's not without its costs, but there is a very strong economic argument to be made that it is an investment that pays for itself over that longer viewshed. And I think we benefit from that longer viewshed. I also think there's some areas, while we're proud of what our teachers have done and our principals and our parents, there are some areas where we have not made the progress that I think we're capable of making, and that has to do with the hiring, the training, the retention, and of quality principals in those hardest to serve schools. And the second area is when it comes to they're actually just flip sides of the same coin. In high school, I think we squander a full year of the high school experience. We pay for it and we squander it. Not all kids do. They find a way to make the most out of it. But we need to move to a point on the horizon where when we look over our shoulders, all of our children graduate from high school not only with that high school diploma, but also with a trade that is recognized and in demand in our economy, and also with a year or two of a trade skill, I should have said, recognized by the industry, and also with a year or two of college education already under their belt before they get out of high school. I think that's the future of the modern high school experience, and I think there's a lot more we could be doing on that.
So is that a support of a Thornton too?
Sure, I support Thornton too.
Thank you.
Sure. And honest, the legislature didn't ask me when they held up the...
So, Governor Martin O'Malley, we only have a couple minutes left in this hour. So I want to thank you for joining
thank
us here
you,
today.
Mark. It's
and,
been a pleasure.
Appreciate you being in here at the 11th Avenue Annapolis Summit. And good luck on your last year.
Thank you.
As governor. And what's next?
I don't know. What's next is the... What's next is the opening
day. Are we running for president,
session.
Governor?
Yeah, is that the... I'm going to do the best job I possibly can in this remaining year that I have to serve the people of our state. And I consider myself so very fortunate. I mean, the kind mentions about my possibly running in 2016 are fueled to a large degree by the accomplishments of the people that I've been able to serve over these last 7 years. And I'm so very proud of what our people have achieved, and I want to make sure that I give back all that they have given to me in giving me this opportunity. So I'm going to focus on being the best I can be in service to others over these next 12 months.
Well, thank you, Governor Martin O'Malley, for being here. 11th Annual Annapolis Summit with our partners, The Daily Record. Of course, you're listening to this on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio. And I want to thank our sponsors, Stevens University, Anderson and Cleaver, Maryland State Education Association, Johns Hopkins Center for Livable Future, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development, and DPC, our production partner. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. Stay with us here for the rest of the 11th Annual Annapolis Summit. Governor, thank you so much.
Thank you.